The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom. For those of you listening to this podcast for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow writers about their process and technique.
So we are taking a bit of a diversion away from the comfortable surroundings of prose, even our experimental prose fiction that we normally speak to.
Not always comfortable, but we're taking a diversion this month anyway.
If it's comfortable, it perhaps isn't fitting our remit properly. But we decided, at least I decided, you may feel far more comfortable in the waters of poetry to just ignorantly stumble through the undergrowth of the poetry landscape, speaking to the innovative poet Miguel Cullen.
Yeah, we had a great chat with Miguel, and we talked about his writing in general, but also about his latest book, which is a collection of poetry, which also incorporates it within the cover, its own video screen, which is sort of linked with the text, how he came up with the process of creating this book.
I mean, this could be the first book that we've covered that came with its own USB lead. So, I mean, it's really interesting. And he spoke to us also about how he'd previously done work with sound chips. And actually, we talk about his poetry and how he chose to compose the collection, but also the logistical challenges posed by creating a book with, as he described it, a cardboard iPad within it.
Yeah. Also the risks of having highly flammable batteries within the cover and a small child.
I do feel that I need to say on behalf of Miguel and his publisher that he did allay the fears about any overheating screen. So here is Miguel Cullen.
I was just going to ask whether you started writing in English or Spanish first.
I actually wrote a poem once when I was quite young. I think it was in English. It was about the sea. And I was, I think, about 8 or something, and or 6. And it was about the sea. And I was on Copacabana Beach because we were in Argentina and we were stopping off on the way. And I remember it being, I think it must have been in English, but I can't remember anything about the poem. Doubtless bad. But I think in English, but, you know, like it always, for some reason, words, because I studied language at university after about 4 years of GCSE and A-level and stuff. I suppose just the sort of Bristol, you know, just the sort of very fact that I went to university and that's my sort of degree, sense of utilitarianism comes in, and I like want to use my languages and use French and Spanish and romance languages, and I tend to find they're sort of softer, can lead to kind of poems which are slightly less sort of harsh in their assonances and, you know, the sound of it. I think my first, when I started writing poetry, it was in English.
What did you speak at home, or did you speak a mix? Or?
I spoke English with my brother, quite close in age. At school, I spoke English, and then to my dad, I spoke English. I spoke Spanish, but a mixture, but probably about 50% or 70% Spanish. And then my mum, English. And then, you know, I had various relations and, you know, but all my Argentine relations are in Argentina.
It's always been quite a mix of languages. It's not, you've not sort of compartmentalized it at any point of, I speak this here. And, I mean, I guess to some extent, but it sounds as though there was always a sort of mix.
Definitely. No, there was a sort of like, you know, my mum would occasionally learn to put in Spanish words for stuff that you couldn't know. And even in my family now, actually, when I've got a daughter who's 4, my wife, we sort of mix it up. She's half Spanish, my wife, just happened to be. But I think we definitely, just in baby talk, we already started incorporating like Spanish words like leche or dede, which is the dummy and stuff like that. And then slowly we're kind of trying to get her to learn Spanish. Yeah, I mean, you know, I've always been useless at other languages. I tried Greek at one point and I was useless. I couldn't learn it at all. I think it's just that romance kind of cheat sheet is really important.
for sort of hearing the music of it, I guess you sort of have just a sense of it. Weird. I also have a child. We're trying to bring up bilingual. I'm not contributing very much, but that's Slovene and English. But I was listening to a guy who did a TED talk quite recently. Him and his brother, I think they run like an app or something for language learning. And he was saying that there's all these myths about how you can't do it. But him and his twin brother set themselves a challenge to learn Turkish in, I think he said, 3 weeks. And he was like, obviously you can't learn it fluently, but you can get, if you know the way to approach it, you can do it really well.
Oh, really? 3 weeks.
It's an interesting approach, but I think the fact that him and his, like they're twins, him and his brother each speak 20 languages and consider themselves polyglots. And they're saying, wow. It's easy. Like anyone can do it. It's like, well, no, your brain obviously works that way.
Yeah.
I don't know that everyone can do it.
I think it's those languages that sort of, I suppose there's a way of doing it, but I suppose it's like, I don't know, like speed learning or just having a great ear. It's like especially languages which come from the Far East or the Near East or East. I definitely think they're much more difficult because, I mean, something like Slovenian would just be lost. I wouldn't know where to start. But I think there's definitely a kind of way of approaching it which isn't learning by rote and stuff like that, which you can sort of pick up a sort of conversational tone in which you can kind of use your ear to kind of, because when I write poetry, like I use my ear a lot in terms, I don't think of way to finish a sentence. I always think with my ear, like what would be the next word? And it sometimes makes sort of a dreamlike sense. So I suppose if you sort of are open to your mind's eye the whole time and you suddenly hear a way of constructing a sentence in Turkish, having consumed some of the language, some of the vocabulary, grammar, I think it's German, isn't it, that has like declensions and conjugations and all that. And I'm like, oh my God.
So when you were at university and you were studying languages, were you writing poetry as well?
No, I was doing a bit of journalism. I was interviewing for the local student newspaper using my languages. I interviewed Orisha, who were this kind of epic Cuban hip hop band. And then apart from that, I was sort of quite into the sort of grittier side of the edgy side of, you know, nightlife and partying, basically. And I was like, I ended up sort of wanting to maybe try an MC on the mic and stuff like that. And for that, I would write lyrics. And I remember a friend of mine gave me a little notebook, and I would sort of think of sort of outrageous lyrics to kind of capture the attention of my classmates, and lyrics about Lokes, you know, current events, and sort of, and then it ended up going on the radio. So we ended up sort of having a friend who was at the Student Union Radio, and we just did we had a set every week. And I would write lyrics about my favourite topic, which was slightly sort of postmodern Renaissance thing. So I did this thing about Renaissance, mixing it with drum and bass and stuff like that, the Renaissance painting genre. Yeah, it was sort of went down terribly when I did it because I didn't know it by heart. And then I started sort of writing when I was working in advertising. I was like, I would like write poetry when I had a moment and read poetry, which is what I loved. And then continuing on from that, I don't know how, but basically kind of started trying to write poetry again when I was about 28, actually quite late, having sort of been doing music journalism and stuff like that. I was working in music journalism for Clash magazine, this music magazine. And for different people, like the sort of independent and, you know, I was doing things on music I loved. I was quite into certain music. And then in sort of circa 2009 or something, I started writing about London and, you know, stress and, you know, the stress of not really being able to kind of work because it was 2008. There was the financial crash and stuff. And I started getting quite stressed because I wasn't succeeding in doing what I thought I'd be doing. You know, I just thought I thought maybe I'd have some like structure, and I was just like struggling as a freelancer. Got laid off from, I was doing some shifts at the Times as a foreign desk assistant, and I was working for a local newspaper, the Hackney Gazette. And I just started writing. I was like, well, I'm writing. So I wrote poetry, and then I would always submit to like Ambit and like, you know, Really High Hopes and stuff. And I just started, so it just takes so long, you know, get it up to speed.
Was that the same sort of process as when you were writing the lyrics earlier? Did it feel like a continuation of the same thing, or was that quite a different approach you were taking when you were starting to write poetry then? Did you have a notebook in the same way that you were sort of jotting down ideas?
I had a notebook and I would write on paper. I didn't have a laptop that I would use back then. It was similar, you know, it would be a bit more intense. The lyrics would be sort of like more about slang and kind of, I suppose the first book I wrote, which was in 2014, of poetry, Wave Caps, that was sort of, it was definitely very, everyone talks about how rhythmical it was and, you know, and the sort of eclectic kind of mix. And yeah, I think too, you know, that it's a similar thing. It's a bit of a weak spot for me really, because sometimes I feel my poetry is not sort of, I'm a sort of bit of an amateur critic as well. It's definitely a different process, because with the lyrics, I was trying to think, with the emceeing, I was trying to think of a rhyme, you know, different things like that. And with the poetry, it's a lot more of a mindful process.
Is it something that takes, are you sort of working and reworking the poetry, or would you sometimes just find you get hit by an idea and 20 minutes later it's all on the page?
No, like there's quite a lot of working, reworking, but always working with the sort of spider senses out there. So like you're working, reworking, and then you work with the spider senses out there, you know, you eventually kind of come out with something that's, because you can actually kind of be quite, you can actually kind of break down quite well with spider senses, if you want to call them that, you know, with spider senses, you can break it down quite well if you sort of rework and rework and rework. And then even if you change, like I had, I think it was W.H. Auden who would sort of get something wrong in a poem about Iceland or something. And he would say, oh, well, you know, to his friend, actually, I meant this word, like were, not when. But I think when works much better. You get to the stage where if you change a word, like it still means the same in the poem. If you change a letter or something, you become a different poem. There are so many different ways it could go. But the general picture is a bit impressionistic, and it could sort of be just as well with a word like that. And the general afflatus, you know, the movement and the sort of the kind of tone as well. The tone, yeah, it's a tone. Tone poems are really important and stuff. And the general feeling it gives, it evokes, is important. And I get told that my poems sort of, they don't know what's exactly going on, but the mood is, you know, there is definitely a resonance, almost a musical or a kind of mood kind of feeling that comes from it.
Is that the only sort of factor? When you're reworking a poem, are you sort of going on Wikipedia and checking things or doing any research around it, or is it purely coming from how the spider senses relate to the words?
Yeah, definitely. You know, for example, some of this book is certain figures. So let's say I want to write a poem about people, you know, because that's something that works into my book. So for example, when I wanted to write, let's say I want to write a poem about Kevin Costner, sort of slightly debunking his whole persona and creating something comedic about Kevin Costner, about how, in the sense that, you know, it could be the basis of quite an amusing poem. And I don't know certain things about Kevin Costner, so I would Google it and find out, and that would feed my, you know, my interest. Also with books I read, for example, I take sort of phrases, or I do find that it's slightly unattractive to kind of create something that is totally on spider senses, because it just can become a slightly amorphous kind of sense, stink or smell or just a poem that, you know, I'd like my poems to have twinkling kind of beautiful kind of soft vowels and soft sort of consonants, and like maybe a poet who is, you know, working clearly and quietly with sound and stuff like that. You know, I think reading is very important with the poems, and you have to kind of, it sort of releases you from a certain stricture as well. I remember reading A House for Mr. Biswas by V.S. Naipaul, and then I wrote a poem and it was a bit like that. It came sort of naturally, you know, it just came out. I think there's a sense of forbidding when you haven't read much and you feel that you need to go every place to sort of, you know, forgiveness when you read a big book and a novel, for example, and you realise that just gives you more space to write in, basically.
And do you find that you pick up this sort of tone and things from stuff you read in general? Is that sort of part of how your mind works, or is that specifically because of that book?
Yeah, I think so, maybe. Yeah, for example, I was just reading the biography of V.S. Naipaul just now, and I wrote something in a poem that was sort of quite squalid, a bit like a Naipaul sort of instance. I think maybe that would influence it, but in terms of tone, I would say that it's something that I have. I can have quite a sort of playful tone more, and like a playful tone or a sort of mocking, slightly gently mocking, but not quite, like gentle, playful tone. That's my tone. And then other tones I can pick up, like one I did recently was just like Larkin, in the sense of growing old, Take Me Down Cemetery Road and vaudeville, kind of like old person slash kind of beautiful nostalgia. So I was just cycling down the cycle path, and it's like, you know, I'm not exactly Bradley Wiggins. I think that whole physical process leads to a sense of sort of resignation. You know, you can be like, oh, you know, and then that can lead to something quite interesting, actually.
Do you have the tone always with it when you're cycling down the cycle path, for instance? Do you have an idea? Is it always the fragment from the poem that, if you're going to write down a note, is it going to be a few lines of poetry, or could it just be a note, a cycle path or something to remind you, and then it's only at a later stage that you actually start the process of pulling the words together and creating the tone in the poem itself?
I've got to say, to be honest, I haven't actually... Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of that question, I think sometimes you can just think... I sometimes think of a phrase in my head, thing for the poem. And I've read actually quite often that people can do that, that people think of a sort of just a little joke, like a sort of double negative or something, and then that kicks the poem off like a paradox, or it doesn't have to be... But just that, and then I've read that quite a lot, so I think that's quite a sort of common thing. And it can be cycle path, obviously, or like, I want to, you know, write about my dad or whatever. But I think I don't actually take notes enough. And I did a course with Simon Barraclough, and he was like, you should carry a notebook. You know, your well of creativity might not get, not, you know, it's probably going to dry up a little bit as you go into your 50s or 40s or whatever. And I was like, ugh. You know, damn, because I'm not very good at writing things down. And actually, V.S. Naipaul does that. He never used to take notes in the first bit, but then when he got to like 40, which I am, then he started.
I suppose it's the sort of thing that if it's not your habit, it's sort of an adjustment to start doing it. You don't do anything at all. You don't sort of record voice notes really on your phone. You just rely on the old memory.
I should. I do. Well, I do sometimes write text. Like when you get a text from, like, you know, one of these places like Amazon or whatever, I text them back with my idea. But I don't know why I do that. And I just sort of, I could just write in Google Docs, you know, what if I got a moment? And then you get loads of messages back saying kind of like, what are you doing? The text has not gone through. Message send failure. Anyway.
I think that is the, we've not heard that method of note taking before on the podcast.
I mean, it fits the bill as an unsound method, I would definitely say.
<I'm glad. laughs>
But I think, I don't know, it becomes a bit of a crutch though once you've got a Google Doc or something running. And I wish there was, honestly, I wish there were better companies to work with, but I do find that Google is just very, very easy to have a doc just lying there waiting. You do fall into just any old nonsense making it on there. It's almost like it's too easy. If you had to take a notebook out to write something down, you might refine it a little bit. It's particularly like this sort of later on a Sunday morning when I'll have a look at what, oh yeah, I wrote something down last night after we've been out for some drinks. And they'll be like, what was that? That's not doing anything.
Yeah. Totally. It's like when someone's been on LSD and they're kind of like, they had this whole theory and apparently they wrote it down really cleverly. And then they wake up in the morning and see what they wrote. And it was like orange juice or something like that. Impressive. Yeah,
there is the issue as well. Once you have all the notes, there is then the process of, even if they're good notes in amongst there, you've got to disentangle them all and somehow structure that into something else.
I was reading about James Womack. Have you heard of him? He's a coconut poet. And he's like sort of a bit of a buddy of mine via Twitter. I've never met him. And he wrote this really cool long poem that came out during lockdown 2020. And he just, you know, like many poets, they write it from notes. And he had a Hawthornden fellowship. And so he went to this castle and sort of like in his room and, you know, wrote it there as a writer's retreat. Did it from notes. And it's just incredibly, you can tell he makes notes because he has so many kind of little nuggets that he must have noted down. And if you want to do something like a long poem, the good thing about a collection is that you can kind of have one poem and then you can just collect them together. But for a long, I don't know, actually. No, I think you need to make notes. Yeah, I've got to get better at that.
It's sort of related to that. In terms of your sort of daily routine or your writing routine, Firstly, do you have any sort of routine on a daily basis in terms of writing?
Well, it depends. I tend to find that that I go through periods of intense productivity, which I'm sort of in the middle of one at the moment. And it's not like I sort of manage a property and then I have other forms of making income. So I feel that with the poetry, I do it. And also I'm a dad and stuff. So I tend to do it like I go through periods. So sometimes I'm actually quite slow. So I don't have a routine where I sit down every day and write or every night. And then at the same time, when I do write, I actually had a phone for quite a long time. And I didn't have a laptop, so I would write on my phone. I wrote quite a lot of my last book on my phone, probably shows. I think the fact is that once I have a poem on Google Docs, I have it on Google Docs on my phone, and then I tend to take it everywhere with me. So wherever I go, I try and get some inspiration. I tend to find that if you write outdoors, I smoke, so I sort of go outdoors intermittently to do that when I'm writing. And I tend to find that if you smoke, if you have fresh air, you tend to write better if it's in the mornings. But in the evenings, it can be anything and you're still tired. When I do have a routine, when I was writing the core of Hologram or just some of the funny poems, I would write at night. I would get tired by about 10 because I've got this, well, I'm just tired. So I'd write something in about 4 hours. No, in about 2 hours or 3 hours, like between sort of 8 when Mary got to bed and 10:30. And then I would wake up in the morning really early, like at about 6 or something, and I would just rewrite it, and then I would work on it for the next few days, kind of thing.
And would that be, do you sort of start from the start of the poem and then add on from there, like in sort of building the poem forward, or is it a case of putting a line down here, a line down there, and then you think of something, that could be the start now, and you add some lines at the start?
Well, it tends to be that, yeah. So I tend to think of the first line quite quickly, actually. Like the first line is often sort of quite punchy. I tend to find the end is quite difficult. I don't know how to tie up the balloon. So I don't know how to sort of make my poem airtight and for it to float. And that's the problem.
Sylvia, what started you writing poetry?
I don't know what started me. I just wrote it from the time I was quite small. I guess I liked nursery rhymes, and I guess I thought I could sort of do the same thing. I wrote my first poem, my first published poem, when I was 8 and a half. It came out in the Boston Traveler. And from then on, I suppose I've been a bit of a professional.
In terms of the sort of time that you're working on the poem, trying to find the way to tie up the balloon, is it that sort of a few days, like from starting with a blank Google Doc?
Well, it depends. I remember with my second book, actually, I wrote a really long poem. I think I wrote the core of it in one go in like one morning, and then I kind of added to it loads, and I was working on it forever on my phone. It was always on my phone. I was always with it, and I would just, because it was really important to me, it's called Lieutenant Dan. And I think I worked on that for a very long time. I think when people say that they're working on a poem, it's not like they're sort of constantly rewriting and rewriting, because I think the process of that is tiring. After a while, you get it's quite intense. Mm. If you're always trying to think of a new line and a new, I don't know. I don't think I'm that sort of, I think the thing that A.M. Wilson said about John Betjeman was that his poems could do with a few more trips to the tailors just to kind of adjust them, you know? I think that's definitely true of a lot of my poetry, that I could just, instead of sending it out on my, not a lot of it, but with some of my poetry, instead of sending it out on a newsletter, I could work on it on my own first. Because I have a newsletter that I send it out to, which has about 400 people on it. And I send it out, and not a lot of people get back to you, but they always say when you see them eventually that they've been enjoying them.
Do you ever find that feedback changes the poem? Like, do you sort of get feedback from somebody who's read it at an early stage and then it changes the direction? Or
yeah, it can. I tend to find that it's nice to get feedback from people, and it always tends to be quite positive. And it can change poems. Yeah, definitely. For example, if I was going to change something, then I'd keep it if they said it was good. If I was thinking it wasn't worth something. And then someone would say something. Like, my dad's a writer as well, and he writes novels, and he was saying that when he was writing his second novel, that he wouldn't have thought any of it was worth anything unless someone had sort of said to him, actually, this is, because he'd published his first novel quite late in life. And he got a good review. He was in the Literary Review. He got a review, like page review and stuff. It was awesome. And he was in the TNS and as a book of the year and stuff. He did that. But at the same time, like, he didn't realize it was any good until some people said it was good, like personal feedback or maybe in a review or whatever. He was like, this is actually quite good because I have. But actually, he knew he was good. But sometimes it can be, you're so close to it. You're so close to the poem that you can't really value it, even though you can value it sometimes.
Did you ever talk to him about the different approaches regarding how he approaches prose and how you approach poetry? And
with the poetry, yeah, he's always encouraging me. He's a great encourager. So he's really important to my poetry. It's a pleasure to have conversations like these with you guys because it reminds me a bit of talking with my dad. It's great to talk about writing. I don't really talk about that much. He's always saying that I should write more prose, or what he said is that you don't have to make as much effort when you're writing prose, you know, because there's a lot of work.
If you tried writing prose at all, if that is an avenue you'd explored.
I have written prose poem. I haven't written anything like a novel or anything, but I've written journalism. So my latest article that I wrote is about being Jamaican and how, like, kids want to be Jamaican and they're not white kids, you know, like the sort of, like, kids want to be Mobb Deep or who are sort of, you know, middle-class kids from the burbs or whatever. So I wrote this piece about that and the sort of only journalism, really. I did try a long prose poem, which is based on my baby and London. I think it was loads of poems in one thing. Almost feels like a waste.
I wanted to ask, I guess this relates to the longer form, how you go about planning a collection and at what point you decide that something belong or like these poems I've been working on maybe could lead to a collection, how you decide what goes in, what doesn't. So at what point do you make the decision? How do you make the decision?
Well, I had a concept for the latest book, and it was kind of for Hologram, which is that it was going to be, I was doing these kind of masquerades of people and sort of slightly Mickey-taking behind a kind of mask and pretending I was them, you know, sort of impressions, or he liked to do the voices. I was trying to kind of do impressions of people and like Matt Damon or Donald Trump or, you know, someone more serious like Francis of Assisi, or just trying little sketches. And basically it grew into a sort of collection of a gallery of faces, you know. So I thought maybe it'd be quite a good idea to do something like dinner party or guest list, favorite dinner party. I think in general, I don't really know like how, you know, people do them.
Were there people for Hologram who weren't on the stragglers or the guest list? Were there some that you wrote that just didn't work because you just didn't like the voice, or were you able to sort of work? You had a sort of shortlist of the people you wanted to include or to do the pieces you wanted to include, and you managed to work them all enough to your satisfaction?
There are lots of poems that I was working on that I decided weren't good enough. Poems about different people or, I don't know. Sometimes it's aesthetic. Yeah, I had a huge list of poems that didn't go in. So I think that the whole thing was, it was really cut. And then suddenly, sometimes you think, you know, maybe something's not quite.
A related note on the aesthetics of bringing the collection together, because Hologram obviously is quite unique. I mean, I don't know. I've certainly never come across another book with the sort of screen inbuilt. I don't know if you can talk a little bit about where, you know, what that is and where the idea for that came about, because you know, it kind of changes the overall aesthetic of the book and the collection.
I just sort of the first book I did is called Wave Caps, and that was a collection I did when I was sort of quite into music, and I was quite living in sort of East London in like Dalston, and I was sort of, you know, quite connected to the whole like rave scene, and not connected, but I was sort of living kind of excited by the musical prospects of being a sort of, you know, late 20s and whatever. I can't remember how old I was. I was 28. You know, I was just sort of excited. And I basically wrote a book which had a sound chip, which was in the back of the book, which you could press like one of like a kid's book that you press a button, it makes like mooing or. So anyway, so I did this book. I suppose like still interested in the whole world of kind of performance and sort of, you know, not so much being true to yourself, but maybe being more true to kind of, you know, what it looks like or performance and how it comes across or how you feel with the performance. And but also, to be honest, the poem itself was a bit of a paradox because the poem itself is, you know, contingent to the little sound chip. I'm not going to explain it, but it wasn't just there, you know, like a gimmick. It was quite important for the poem. It's just one poem at the end, but for some reason it happened. And I just felt like I wanted it to be a bit, I think I was saying to someone that like all the books that we used to have at home, literature, my dad's like, would always be reading this kind of silent book that kind of he wouldn't talk to you about and that he'd be taking, his attention would be sort of distracted by this book. And I never knew, and I never felt kind of brave enough to open the books on the bookshelf. When I was young, I was quite a big reader, but the books on his bookshelf always seemed so, you know, stern and stuff, and I wouldn't be able to read all these amazing books. So I suppose I wanted to kind of create something that added a bit of me to the book, you know. I didn't want to write just a plain book. And I often, knowing my dad as well, I knew about how books can be quite sort of anonymous in a way in the current year, in the current age, and they can sort of not speak. I always remember this story about the emperor of the Incas, Atahualpa, and Pizarro turned up at Cusco. He was met by this in this grand scene with Atahualpa with all his cortege. And Pizarro came up and he gave Atahualpa the Bible. And he said through an interpreter, "This is the word of God." And Atahualpa puts up the Bible to his ear and says, "So why does it not speak to me?" And he throws it on the floor. And that's when they started fighting and were defeated by the Spanish conquistadors. So in a way, it's like, you know, I do find it's like, what is a book? And it's like, I love books, you know, I won't deny it, but these Bibles and these kind of heavy things that are sort of, you know, there's this big discourse about, you know, dead white men and all this kind of, you know, who are we to sort of be bowing down and sort of capitulate to the kind of the canon of Western literature, you know, where there's a whole new realm of things that we could be getting involved with. And why do you have to read the classics before you can call yourself a proper writer? And why do you have to kind of believe that poems, the canon of Western literature, which is bound up in sort of imperialism and the white perspective, and in a sense, these kind of conquistador Spaniards, you know, Cervantes, and who would write odes to the victory, who fought in the battle for Philip II and stuff. Why do I have to read Don Quixote?
The whole concept of the canon is kind of questionable. I mean, it's useful to have some shared cultural reference points, but only as a sort of shortcut to some other things. And as a way of saying, look, okay, that's an interesting idea. This is when someone, a notable example of when someone did that. But to have this kind of list that's almost a qualification for being able to know what you're doing is kind of odd. I don't know how we got here because people set syllabuses.
Yeah, I hear you. And then there's the sort of like counter argument, which create this whole sort of toxic debate, which people are like, oh, why do I have to read why I'm not talking to white people about race? And it's just this whole stupid argument about tit for tat. And that, you know, the white Western canon people of the Spectator or whoever is the right wing, they sort of all think that it's stupid to read these new books about race. And then the left are really anti sort of Western literature. It's just, it's such a sort of sterile, and it seems the whole argument is, I'm not saying that I'm not slightly against the Western canon, but anyway, it just seems to be a bit sort of, not that I haven't read some of it, you know, I love like Tolstoy and the Russians and a certain degree some French stuff I read, like Proust, or not all of it. But at the same time, it's like, you know, for example, the Bible, I mean, it's just such a sort of bidding and empty book.
Yeah, I've been trying to tick off some bits of it because I've never, it's not the world I was brought up in and I've never read it, but it's for its cultural importance, I've tried to sort of read the odd book of the Bible sequentially. And I've so far got about, I don't know, 5 books in. And it's all just legal stuff at the moment. It's all just about what you're not allowed to do and what the sanction is for doing it for many, many pages.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I've not read it either, but I've read like sections. I just remember a lot of John who begat 10 pages of who begat who. You were aiming for something different from that with Hologram.
Oh, yeah.
Not necessarily in opposition to it, but certainly something different.
Yeah, I was aiming for something different. To be honest, like when we were doing the videos at first, we weren't sure we were doing the video book yet. So we were just going to, me and this guy, Ivor, who's like super rock and roll. He's this kind of awesome video maker / kind of photographer who, you know, slings on his camera around his neck and he just goes off to wherever and manages to sort of somehow subsist and does so well. And he does things like for Supreme, which is the super cool kind of Down with the Kids label. And he's done fashion shoots with Virgil Abloh. And, you know, he's like awesome. And I get on with him quite well because I met him. I interviewed him for The Quietus. Yeah, I talked to him and we ended up collaborating because he liked my poetry because I was sending it to sort of the newsletter. And I put him on it. And anyway, and he was like really, and I persuaded him to make a few videos over lockdown, a couple of videos. I thought, why not put them in the book? We ended up doing the book and then various things happened and we got another collaborator. He's basically my daughter's godfather. He made a couple of videos. And then we got this awesome video maker, Agustina Comedi, who's this really cool video maker who's Nan Goldin has sort of interviewed her and said how great she is and how she's just like a massive fan. And she made a video about Maradona as well, which I'm hoping to release around the World Cup, some sort of platform. Didn't get into the book, but that essence of it is really exciting. The fall through is that it's obviously just on the book, so you don't really get to see it on the big screen or anything. But it makes it kind of, for me, you know, I've always wanted to kind of like have an element of kind of excitement about the book from a kind of visceral level. We managed to get it done, but it was really difficult because we had to work with this company that made the video modules.
Were there books existing like this that you'd seen, or was it you had the videos and the poetry and you then had to find somebody that could
put it together? Yeah. So the way it worked was that firstly we got a bit of funding from this company that kind of does, it sort of funds kind of like tech projects, and we got a bit of funding from them. And then secondly, what we did is we approached the same company that did my first book, the audio chip for like the talking book, which children use, you know, that audio chip, which is often used on greeting cards. You know, people want a happy birthday song and people can record one and then open a book. And the company also does video brochures. So, you know, it's not exactly rocket science. It's like a cardboard iPad, you know, and it's basically you have this kind of greetings card manufacturer, which works with China. And so we talked to these people who based on the North Circular, and they dealt with China. And then basically to make the book, we used the same people who made my previous two books. And they said they could easily, no problem, kind of put it together, put the module inside the book and sort of create a little box so where the video module could go and then bind the pages on the other side. But it wasn't easy. I didn't have any experience in this. You know, at one point he got in touch with me literally 2 days before we were supposed to receive the books, just before Christmas, because we were doing the whole push. And he said, listen, you know, one of the books is heating up. It got so hot that it was like melting the screen. Do you still want to do this? You know, do you want me to bind all the books? And I was like, fucking hell. I was like, just go for it, because I'm sure this never happens. Because the guy who made this video modules through China, the guy on the North Circular who is making these video brochures, said that never happens in all his history of making these things. So I was kind of like, I received all the books, and so I had them in my house, and I was really worried because the books were downstairs, like in this big pile, and I'm upstairs with my baby and Mary and Vic. I thought it was going to be a fire risk, So, and it was fine in the end, but they would play during the day. During like at night, they would sort of stop playing. I don't know if you've had this. So you hear the first video again and again. It's lucky it's actually quite an amusing video, which is the Brad Pitt one.
The Brad Pitt one, yeah. With the Tootski reference. Just suddenly suddenly floats.
Yeah, that's from Wall Street, Matthew McConaughey at the beginning. Tootski.
But you know, it's you're working out how to do something technologically that someone else hasn't done. So you know, nice. You're going to get woken up in the night sometimes. It's better than being woken up by the fire alarm.
No, exactly. I was thinking even how to get out of the house. You know.
Thank you to Miguel for joining us, and thank you for listening. We will put some links to Miguel and his writing under this in the episode notes.
And you can find more about Unsound Methods on our website, unsoundmethods.co.uk, or do follow us on Twitter. We're at Unsound Methods. And do remember to like, subscribe the podcast wherever you find it.
Yeah, pass it on. I mean, if there's other like-minded folk you know of, please do, you know, pass on word of it. It does seem that, you know, word of mouth and people sharing it as a discovery seems to be one of the best ways to get it out there. So we appreciate everyone who celebrates it. You can find out more about me and my writing at Jamie Batchen on Twitter, at Jamie_Batchen on Instagram, and jamiebatchen.com is my website.
And you can find me and my writing at LachlanBloom.com, or I'm on Twitter at LachlanBloom. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.